This is Insight and Outlook. I'm Scott London. Today, a conversation with Elizabeth Sartouris and the late Willis Harmon about new frontiers in science.
I used to think that the mechanical worldview had imposed on us mechanical structures and that our societies were really built like machines. But the fact is that you can't turn living things into machinery. You can try to force them to behave like machinery, but they will not be machinery. And that's exactly why our economists can't predict anymore and our politics is falling apart, because we don't understand them as unhealthy living systems. We're trying to fix them like machines.
Science is exquisite for what it set out to do. Which was to control the physical universe in various ways, which then could be turned to the benefit of the economy and so on. But if from that science we're going to try to construct a worldview that we're going to live by and we're going to guide our society by, then it's not adequate.
In the late 60s, historian of science Thomas Kuhn introduced the concept of a paradigm to describe a conceptual model or set of assumptions about reality. A paradigm, he said, allows scientists to interpret data, elaborate theories, and solve problems. It can be as all-encompassing as Newtonian physics, or as specific as the notion that life exists only on Earth. The trouble, he explained, is that paradigms are resistant to change. They're like closed systems in which all new data tends to confirm what's already known. Well, there's a growing recognition today that the old mechanistic paradigm passed down from the Enlightenment doesn't work very well in addressing the pressing questions of modern science. This is reflected in the emergence of new fringe disciplines with names like chaos, complexity, and living systems theory. Biologist Elizabeth Sartouris sees a shift today from what she calls mechanics to organics. Scientists no longer speak of the world as a giant clockwork machine, as the great Enlightenment thinkers conceived it, but rather as an organic living system. Sartouris makes this point in a new book written with the late social scientist Willis Harmon called Biology Revisioned. The book surveys recent changes in biology and looks at some of the social and cultural ramifications of these changes. Elizabeth Sartouris is an evolution biologist based in the Bay Area and author of several books, including Gaia and A Walk Through Time. She's also a futurist and former consultant to the United Nations. When I asked her about the shift toward a more organic perspective now taking place in the scientific community, she told me that many scientists still have trouble with the idea of nature as a living system.
Goes back to the Cartesian worldview, I think, in which Descartes proposed God as a grand engineer and his creations as mechanisms. That meant all nature was an array of mechanisms created by God the engineer, who then put a piece of his favorite, of his God mind into his favorite robot, man, so that he too could create machinery. Now, that was, whether you like it or not, a logically complete worldview. It accounted for everything. When the scientists decided they didn't need God in their worldview, they eliminated God from the Cartesian worldview but kept the idea of an array of mechanisms. Now, how do you explain the origin of mechanisms without a creator? By definition, a machine cannot exist without a creator. So if they're there and they couldn't have been assembled on purpose by an intentional creator, the only alternative was to say they came together by accident. And so you got these bizarre theories that literally say if enough parts of a Boeing 707 blow around a whirlwind in a junkyard, eventually one will assemble itself. This is going to appear to us, I think, the most bizarre and perhaps harebrained concept of how things work that's ever been proposed in the history of the world. And I think that it will be seen that way in the very near future because it is fundamentally an illogical point of view. The problem was that they thought you had to choose between God, the purpose of inventor, and accident. We had no theory of self-creation as a perfectly natural biological universal event. Now we do, so we don't have to invoke either hypothesis.
In a nutshell, what is the Gaia theory?
Jim Lovelock is an atmospheric scientist from England, and he proposed that the Earth was a living, self-organizing entity and called it Gaia after the Greek name of the original goddess of creation who became the earth itself. I differ a little bit with Lovelock and Margulis in the way I talk about Gaia, because I never call it either a hypothesis, which was what they first called it, or a theory. To me, it's a conceptualization of the Earth as alive to replace our conceptualization of the Earth as an array of mechanisms. And it's part of the transition in general from a mechanical worldview to an organic worldview, to see the Earth as alive. And for me, it's alive by definition. I use the definition of life, which was proposed by two biologists from South America, Maturana and Varela, which goes by the name of autopoiesis. And autopoiesis is a Greek word, of course, meaning literally self-creation. And the definition goes, a living entity is any entity that constantly creates itself. And this really distinguishes it from a mechanism, because a machine is not constantly creating itself. In fact, if it changes itself at all, it's probably broken, and you'd rather it didn't do that, while a living thing is always changing or it's dead. And so it's a conceptualization, not a hypothesis or a theory. Within that conceptualization, that scientific framework, you would propose hypotheses and make theories about how it functions.
When James Lovelock first proposed this idea, he said he was using very poetic and metaphorical language. So in addition to presenting this as a scientific hypothesis, he was also using it as a metaphor. Well, today the Gaia theory, or the Gaia hypothesis, is bandied around a lot as a nice metaphor. But is it taken seriously by the scientific community?
Well, one of the things that happened was that people who get identified as New Age, and that means a lot of things, got very excited about the Gaia hypothesis from Jim Lovelock, because intuitively everyone knows that nature is alive, that the Earth is alive. In fact, our Western industrial culture is the only one in history that has not known the Earth to be alive. But when people say it's just a metaphor, we really have to look at that, because all science is metaphor. And when you say that nature is an array of mechanisms, that's absolutely as metaphorical as saying it's a living entity. There is no way to talk about anything new without invoking metaphors. So all of science is based on metaphor. If you talk about an atom as being like a little solar system with planets around it, or like whirlpools of energy in the more recent descriptions, these are all metaphors. Metaphor simply means that you take something familiar to you and use it as a pictograph or an image of what you're trying to describe that you don't yet understand well.
One of the enduring metaphors of our scientific worldview is Darwinism, of course, the whole idea of natural selection and survival of the fittest and so on. Darwinism has had a monumental impact on the way we think about evolution and our place in nature. And yet, in your book here, you're basically suggesting that we need to reassess Darwinian theory.
Yes, I think Darwin's theory was good for its time, but remember that its time was within a mechanical worldview framework. And to me, Darwin's theory is a very mechanical one, in which you have accidents that occur. Remember, we talked earlier about explaining a natural world of machinery by accidental development. So that notion was around. And then the accidental variation in the genetic material is shaped by the environment, which Darwin saw as a kind of template. And if the cogs of these accidents fit into the wheels of the environment, then it would survive and the machine would run on. And if it didn't, it would die out. It would be inappropriate. It occurred to me that life seemed to be much too intelligent to proceed in its evolution by accident. And I kind of stuck my neck out 10 years ago by saying that. I thought probably genetic errors were repaired. Arthur Koestler had some similar ideas. I believe that was one of my sources for these ideas. Now the geneticists are becoming aware of this at a microscopic level. We can look at what's happening with the relationship between proteins and genes and cell membranes and all that. And it looks very much as though life does not proceed by accident, but by design. And that, as I said in my book, the nucleus is really a giant library of genes accumulated throughout evolution, which can be drawn on under stress. Now, creatures such as sharks or cockroaches are very well adapted and don't apparently need to change. I call them bicycles in a jet age because they still function very well, although other species have gone on with totally different paths of evolution. But in other words, life changes itself only when it needs to. It knows how to conserve what works well and change what doesn't work well. And that's why you get very uneven evolution, not as in Darwinian theory, which would predict a very even rate of accident and an even rate of evolution for all species. And we certainly know that that's not true, and no geneticist today would uphold the ideas of Darwin completely. From my point of view, the concept of living systems should be the overarching concept for all of our educational institutions. In other words, we should be teaching the politics of living systems, the economics of living systems, the science of living systems. All of these things would be united by that central concept. And this is what would help us as humans to form healthy living systems. I used to think that the mechanical worldview had imposed on us mechanical structures and that our societies were really built like machines. But the fact is that you can't turn living things into machinery. You can try to force them to behave like machinery, but they will not be machinery. And that's exactly why our economists can't predict anymore and our politics is falling apart. Because we don't understand them as unhealthy living systems. We're trying to fix them like machines. It's very different curing a person and fixing a machine.
Biologist Elizabeth Satouris. Her new book, co-authored with Willis Harmon, is called Biology Revision. This is Insight and Outlook. I'm Scott London. Much of Biology Revisioned is written in the form of a dialogue between Elizabeth Satouris and Willis Harmon. The two authors were friends and had a long-standing interest in the frontiers of modern science. Harmon served as president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences for almost two decades. He was also a senior social scientist at SRI International for many years and taught at Stanford during the 40s and 50s. He authored quite a few books. One of the best known, Global Mind Change, has just been issued in a splendid revised edition. He passed away last year after a brief illness, shortly after he and Satouris completed Biology Revisioned. In what was to be one of his final interviews, I asked him about his perspective on what's happening in science today.
I think there are really two things happening. There are things that are happening out on the leading edge of science as we know it. And then there's a little bit of conversation about a more or less forbidden topic, which is a re-examination of the metaphysical assumptions that are implicit in Western science, but that they don't tell us about when we take science classes.
The metaphysical assumptions?
Yes. There's an epistemological assumption, that is, an assumption about how do you know what you claim to know. And then there's also an ontological assumption about what is the nature of reality. And so there's some of both. The epistemological assumption, for example, is that the way you find out about scientific knowledge is very largely in terms of being objective, that is, being distant from what's being observed, not being involved with it. There's an assumption that we really understand something when we reduce the complex to the simple, we reduce the whole to the parts. We call that reductionism, so that's an assumption. There's an ontological assumption, an assumption about the nature of reality, that the nature of reality is what is physically measurable. And if there's anything else, We won't say much about it in science, and if we don't say much about it, nobody else better say much about it, because science is the only widely recognized cognitive authority in the whole modern world.
Mm-hmm.
Western science has been tremendously good at what it does, and what it does is to lay the foundations for the manipulation of the physical world, the generation of new technologies, and so on. And nobody would attempt to downgrade that at all. But it nevertheless is limited. There are areas of human experience that it doesn't tell us much about. And if we took a more comprehensive epistemology, changed the rules of the game, so to speak, how do we know what we claim to know, then it could explore a wider range of human experience and be even more valuable.
Elizabeth Satouris, who you're working with on a new book now, she says when Galileo looked through his telescope that it was really an accident, you might say, or it had tremendous implications for the development of science, that he looked through it toward the stars instead of looking through it from the other end and using it as a microscope, and that maybe our focus on physics as the primary science would have instead resulted in the emphasis on biology as a primary science.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And that's just another way of saying what I was saying earlier about if we did come upon, by a more or less a historical accident, the idea that physics is the core discipline in the sciences, and what is real is the fundamental particles studied in physics. But you can imagine another argument which would have said, but living systems are the thing to be studied, and so biology should be the core discipline, and physics is a special case where there isn't evident life, but to really understand things, you need to understand living systems. Now, if you took that approach, then you would never would occur to you to say the real way to study organisms is to pull them apart until you get down to the molecular level and then study the molecules and understand the DNA so that you can understand the organism. You know, it would have from the very beginning been a study of everything as both a whole in itself and part of a larger whole. And it isn't that we wouldn't have the kind of scientific knowledge that we have, but we would have it in a very, very different context, and we would draw different inferences from it about the nature and the meaning of life and so on.
You've reassessed some of Darwin's ideas and also some of the neo-Darwinians who are getting a lot of attention mm-hmm. these days. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's right. There are many people who are questioning well, this term neo-Darwinism, perhaps we need to explain. Darwinism had the basic concepts of accidental mutations and survival of the fittest, but then added to that came the detailed knowledge about just how the basic knowledge about the organism is transmitted to the next generation through the genes and through the DNA and so on. And so that combination is called neo-Darwinism, and it does seem to explain a lot, but it also has a lot of mysteries associated with it. And so there have been a number of criticisms essentially saying that it probably is going to require some change, but I'm not aware of very many people who've gone as far as Elizabeth and I want to in saying, but if we start from holes within holes, then the neo-Darwinism is a framework, but it just isn't big enough to contain all of this. And if you think about all of this in terms of consciousness being present throughout, then you get a different look at it. A lot of what's known about evolution will still stand, but some of the mysteries will be viewed in a different way. Science is exquisite for what it set out to do, which was to control the physical universe in various ways, which then could be turned to the benefit of the economy and so on. It's just that we've reached a point where, since it now is the only cognitive authority that we teach everybody about, we assume this is the one thing that everybody around the world knows for true, Well, if we're going to take that attitude toward it, then we need to insist that it broaden its aperture, that it look at the full range of human experience, not just at a constrained range. And to do that, you have to reassess the metaphysical assumptions underlying it and understand how some of those assumptions that were made early in the game have, in fact, been limiting with regard to the overall. Let's put it this way: if the place in society for science were merely to create technologies, it's okay the way it is. But if from that science we're going to try to construct a worldview that we're going to live by and we're going to guide our society by, then it's not adequate, and these questions must be raised.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me something about your own approach to science. At a certain point, you must have begun to challenge your own traditional viewpoint and started to explore alternative approaches to science. Tell me about your own journey in that respect.
Well, I taught engineering at Stanford University for a good many years, and that evolved over teaching about systems, and then it became not just engineering systems, but engineering, economic, social systems. And about at that point, it didn't really fit into any department at Stanford anymore, and I moved over to Stanford Research Institute, or now it's SRI International, to do research on whole social systems, and particularly with regard to the kinds of changes that are taking place in modern society, the kinds of challenges to modern society, the environmental problems and so on. We were trying to look to the future 20 or 30 years or so, but the more that we looked at that together, the more we said, this is just after the 60s, and there seems to be a great deal of change in consciousness that's been associated with the 60s, and the more we looked into that, the more we began to say to ourselves and to our clients that it looks as though in the popular culture there's a spreading group that is really operating from a different worldview. And it's one they've discovered themselves, and it isn't exactly traditional religion, and it certainly isn't traditional science. It's something else. It looks as though there's a new cosmology coming into the culture.
Well, it seems to me, I think I've read a bit about SRI, that they were involved in pretty controversial research during the 60s and 70s, and like remote viewing and so on, and doing work for the CIA. Is that true?
Well, there was another group there that was working on remote viewing and various kinds of anomalous sorts of phenomena that don't fit into the conventional scientific worldview. And yes, some of that research was funded by the CIA because, you know, if you've got a certain mindset, it's very, very interesting to know if you can send a mind over to the Soviet Union at that time and see where the submarines are under the fog bank and things like that. That was a separate group. We kept in touch with what they were doing. And we assumed that was one of the many inputs that were contributing to our broader picture, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting because, you know, a lot of the research that's being done in the emerging sciences of complexity and chaos now is coming out of the Santa Fe Institute. But as you may know, a lot of the research there has been funded by big business and by arch conservatives and Wall Street investors who are looking to take that research and apply it to very narrow political and economic interests. And I think this is a very scary idea, that the latest breakthroughs in science are being applied to increase the power of those who already have quite a lot.
I think it's really an important issue that you raise. We did have a tradition at one time of trying to see that at least a major portion of the research that goes on is not biased by its funding sources. And universities felt this was very important to them. I think that caution has become somewhat weaker. And partly it's because research has become rather expensive in many areas, and you've got to get your funding from somewhere. And if it's a government agency or big business that fund it, well, you can suspect that there may be some biased interest there. And certainly there are some topics that are easy to fund, and there are other topics that are very difficult to fund because you're asking questions that might even be threatening to the potential funder. So that certainly is a part of the...
But this seems to be a central issue for people who are really on the cutting edge of research, though, because I can't imagine that many truly independent-minded scientists and thinkers who are exploring these areas can be very popular with the establishment. And yet the establishment is responsible for the funding, so...
But the establishment is also shifting. So there are things that happen under the table sometimes. And so there's at least a modest amount of funding that sometimes comes from sources that are not terribly visible. I think what you're saying is just one aspect of something that I would put this way, that the single most important political issue for the next decade or two is what worldview is going to guide all the institutions of society, what's going to be the dominant worldview, and who's going to control it, and who's going to control the research that leads to it or supports it. And that's why we've circled back in this conversation to where we started from, which is that the critical issue in science is not what can you now learn from quantum physics or chaos theory or whatever. Much more fundamental than that is the question, are there ontological and epistemological assumptions about the nature of reality and how you find out about reality, that have been a part of Western science all along. That's why it's different from what science was in any other culture. That may be part of why it was so successful in the limited arena of generating new technologies, new ways of manipulating the physical environment. But at the same time, that's exactly why it's not just a scientific or a philosophical, but a political question in the deepest sense. What bias is there in our present concept of science, and do we need to re-examine that at this point?
That's Willis Harmon, the late president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and author of a new book with Elizabeth Satouris called Biology Revisioned. Harmon is also the author of Global Mind Change, a popular book about our changing worldview in the West. It's just been published in a revised second edition. I spoke with Harmon in San Francisco shortly before he passed away last year. If you'd like to be in touch with your thoughts about the program, the email address is insight@west.net. You can also find out more about Insight and Outlook on the web. Just click on Insight and Outlook at the KCBX website. It's www.kcbx.org. Cassette copies of the program are available for $12. You can send a check or money order to Insight and Outlook, P.O. Box 12, Santa Barbara, California, 93102. Ask for program 441. That address again is Insight and Outlook, P.O. Box 12, Santa Barbara, California, 93102. Insight and Outlook is a weekly program of interviews and ideas. It's produced at KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. I'm Scott London. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again next time.